streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your hosts, Roy and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
Good evening, and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back radio show. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the streets don't love you back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes. As we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight, so stay tuned in to the hottest radio show worldwide.
We have a great show for you tonight. We have Miss Deidre Marie Capone. She is the great niece of the gangster Al Capone, also known as Public Enemy Number One and Scarface. And she's going to tell her story tonight about what she remembers of Uncle Al. And she also wrote a book called Uncle Al Capone. And we'll hear all about that in just a few minutes. Let me go ahead and welcome my co-host, Boyd, to the show, and we'll bring Deidre on in just a couple of minutes.
Yes, thank everybody for tuning in every Wednesday night like you always do. We have a great show for you tonight, and so without further ado, we're going to go and see if our guest is on the air right now. Miss Deidre.
I'm here.
Hey, how you doing, Miss Deidre? How you feel today?
I'm feeling good, Boyd. How are you doing?
Oh, God is always good. You know, it's an honor to have
yep.
you on the show tonight. And we just want you to start from where you feel you want to start from and formally introduce yourself to the audience.
All right. I am Deidre Marie Capone. I am the great-grandniece of Al Capone, the granddaughter of Ralph Capone, Al's oldest brother and business partner.
Wow, and you've led an interesting life and have your own story, actually, of what it was like just growing up with the Capone name, even though you didn't grow up as a youngster, you know, with him. I mean, he was a little bit older in his life when you were born. So, but just loving that Capone name actually, you know, led to a lot of struggles in your life, and we'll let you tell some of those stories here tonight. Go ahead and let us know, just start, you know, when you were young and what happened as you were growing up.
Well, that's, you know, I could have taken my book in a lot of different directions, but I chose to focus on me and hopefully give the reader two things. Number one, I want people to know that there was a human being, a God-fearing, God-loving human being by the name of Al Capone. You know, was he a monster? No, he was a mobster. He was not a monster. Was he a villain? No, he was a victim. You know, I wanted to let people know what made him cry, what made him laugh, what made him, you know, smile and sing. You know, how he sat down and ate and how he treated his family. But then I also wanted the readers to know that even in the face of adversity, even with, you know, all the strikes against you, you can survive and you can rise above things and become the person that you were meant to be. And that's what happened to me.
Definitely. And now, tell us a little bit about, you know, let's go over to Al Capone and tell us, obviously, you know, there's so many different things online that you can read about Al Capone, the different history, and we obviously know that he was a mobster and he was, you know, the head of the Chicago outfit, and, you know, he was a leader, he made a lot of money, one of the greatest mobsters, in history, I would say.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about Al Capone from your perspective or what
there
you know that may be a little bit different than what we know.
You two are much younger than I, and I don't know what kind of an audience you have, but just to, you know, kind of educate you, the Prohibition law was a very, very unfair law. All of a sudden, the federal government tells everybody that lives in the United States of America that they can no longer drink alcohol, and there was no rhyme or reason for it. People still wanted alcohol. I mean, you know, if you lived in the South, if you lived out in the country, they actually, you know, people would make their own stills. My mother's father used to make his own beer in the basement. People would do anything, you know, because they wanted alcohol. They wanted to sit down and relax. My grandfather told me, you know, when I serve alcohol, they call it bootlegging. But when the people on North Shore Drive serve it, they call it hospitality. So it was just a different, you know, perspective. So people wanted alcohol. Al Capone got into trouble. You know, let me educate you guys a little bit more. Back at the turn of the century, Italian immigrants were coming in from Italy. And when they did that, they were the low people on the totem pole. The teachers at school called them greasy, said they smelled, said that they were dumb. They'd never amount to anything. But the people came over to America for the freedom, for the promise, for the opportunity. So, you know, my grandmother and grandfather came over, had all these little children, and there was really no chance for them to become lawyers or doctors or businessmen. They had to find a way to, you know, take care of themselves, you know, find money to buy the things that they wanted to wear on their back and put the food in their mouth. And so they did it by, you know, the sweat of the brow, you know, the fist, whatever it was, to make it work. Well, in 1920, an early year of 1920, Johnny Torrio in Chicago knew about Al Capone, and Johnny Torrio was getting tired, and he was getting afraid of running the outfit. So he sent for Al Capone to come to Chicago for this opportunity to provide alcohol. And so Al brought his wife and son there with him. Shortly after he went to Chicago, their father, Gabriel, dropped dead of a massive stroke. That left my grandfather, who was the oldest, and like most, well, like all Italian families, you know, when the father dies, the oldest boy assumes that responsibility of caring for the family. Well, there was still a mother at home and six siblings. And my grandfather at that time was married and had his own son. And he didn't know what he was going to do, you know, just so he called Al. Al said, you know, Ralph, I think there's an opportunity here. Why don't you come to Chicago and we'll try it out? And my grandfather went to Chicago. They saw the opportunity. Then they went back. They brought their family to Chicago. If that one thing didn't happen, if their father didn't drop dead and then all of a sudden the boys had to take care of their entire family, probably no one today would know who Al Capone was.
Right. And how long did he work with Johnny Torrio?
Very short time. Johnny Torrio turned over the reins to my grandfather and Al, and then Johnny Torrio moved back to Italy. So then my family took over. And they were only involved in three businesses. They were involved in gambling, they were involved in prostitution, and they were involved in alcohol. Nothing else.
Yeah, you know, just looking back and reading about history, that Prohibition era must have been, I mean, it was, I guess, one of the greatest times for some and some of the worst for others. But, you know, and back in those days, even cocaine and morphine and all these other drugs were legal. Marijuana, people use those things.
Of course.
You know, on a daily basis. So to take even alcohol away from people that, you know, had a drink every night with dinner or before they went to bed, you know.
Well, you know, most people did not drink every night. You know, I can remember my husband's father telling me that he used to sit after working very hard all day, and he wished he had enough money to buy a can of beer. So, you know, most people didn't drink. They might have a couple of drinks on the weekend, but during the week they did not. The high society people, remember, this was the 20s. They called it the Roaring 20s for a reason. Women were, you know, coming into their own. They could smoke. They could drink alcohol. The flapper dances. You know, it was wild and crazy times. So those people drank the alcohol. It was kind of the fast, you know, crowd that would drink the alcohol. But most working people couldn't afford it.
And I guess the speakeasies would be like the clubs nowadays.
Correct.
A place where
correct.
You go and drink and listen.
And
to
do you know why
stuff.
They call them speakeasies?
No, not really.
Because when you would go into the place, you had to very silently tell the bartender what you want. You couldn't say, you know, give me, you know, whiskey on the rocks or something like that. You had to speak easy so that nobody would hear you.
Why is that? Just because
because there was police there, you know. They would serve drinks in, you know, mason jars and coffee cups and things like that. They wouldn't serve them, you know, in glasses, so people would come up, and if somebody was observing them, they'd think that, you know, the guy was serving them a cup of coffee or a cup of tea.
Okay. So it was a legal place, just illegal to drink, so they kind of hit it in a different, all right.
Correct. That's what they did, Lucinda.
Interesting. What a time she's lived in, I guess. That's with so many different things going on. And
well, have you watched Boardwalk Empire at all?
No.
That's the new HBO show. And really, you know, what I've been noticing are, you know, the young guys today are starting to dress up a little more. They're putting on hats. And I think it's all because of that era. I mean, people dressed well. They were dapper. They wore nice suits, nice clothes, and great hats. Well, Boardwalk Empire is bringing back the interest in most of you young people today, you know, for nice-looking clothes.
Right. And it seems like nowadays, too, everybody wants to be a gangster. You know, there's obviously a lot of wannabes out there. But, you know, to dress nice and have the jewelry and the fancy cars and mm-hmm. you know, try to look like a mobster, I guess, you know, it's a trend.
Correct. It is a trend right now.
Definitely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Al Capone and what happened with his empire.
Well, the empire still went on. I mean, they took Al Capone out of it. The federal government really, you know, brought a vendetta down on him and literally took him out of power. You know, you don't do battle with the federal government and win, you know, most of the time.
Yeah.
The only thing that they could get him on was tax evasion. And Al Capone has been tried twice since that time, once in 1991 and once this year, 2011, by tax attorneys, and he was found not guilty on all charges. So, but they wanted him gone. The businessmen were concerned about him because he was planning to run for mayor of Chicago, and he would have won, hands down. And he was an honest, you know, guy. He would have run a very, very tight ship, but they wanted him gone. So, I mean, they put a witness on the stand that lied, and they got him for income tax evasion. At one point, Al asked if he could just pay, you know, the government anything, and they said no. So he was arrested and charged with income tax evasion for the same 3 years as Frank Nitti, same 3 years, and my grandfather, same 3 years, same amount of money. My grandfather got 3 years in the federal penitentiary. Nitti got 2 years. Al Capone got 11.
Wow.
So
yeah,
they
the law never consistent.
Yep. And you know, I go out to Alcatraz and I sign my books out there. I'm going out in August, and that's kind of an eye opener. To see the conditions that he had to live in. And he should have never been in Alcatraz. Alcatraz, when you first go out there, there's a sign by the warden saying that Alcatraz is meant for men who could never, they were irredeemable. They could never return back to society again. Well, that wasn't Al Capone.
Right. You know, I know that you've gone out there several times. What was your first feeling being at Alcatraz when you went in and you actually went to the cell that Al Capone stayed in?
I started to cry. I mean, here is a man who in his 30s was literally king of Chicago. And, you know, he could have anything that he wanted. And then he was out there in a cell 6 feet wide, 9 feet deep. It had a bench, it had a bed, it had a toilet, and it had a sink. And that's where he lived.
Right. You know,
the cruel thing about it is that his cell faced the bay. And at nights, you could hear the people in San Francisco clinking glasses and having fun and laughing and things like that, and there he is, you know, locked up in this little cell. And he became a model prisoner. He was sentenced to 11 years. He got out in 7.
Right. You know, and I think, you know, as far as gangsters and mobsters and even gang members, a lot of them are, and most of them are, start out not to be bad people. A lot of them are looking for a place to fit it in, looking for an opportunity, like you said.
Yep.
You know, and as we work with youth now, trying to educate them about gangs and drugs, you know, that's what we see. Kids that, you know, they're smart people but just can't handle the rules in school or need to have a different teaching style. You know, they end up dropping out of school, as Al Capone did.
Al Capone did not drop out of school, or that attention, or that
need to belong somewhere to be. I mean, a lot of them are definitely great leaders. They just end up in the wrong type of leadership, I guess.
Lucinda, Al Capone did not drop out of school. He was a high school graduate.
Oh, he was.
That's misinformation that is out there. My grandfather dropped out of school in sixth grade, but Al Capone was a college or a high school graduate.
Okay.
And they instilled in me how important, you know, education was. You know, yeah, they were gang members, very much unlike the gang members today. There was honor among them. I was raised that your word is your bond and family is everything. And honor, you honored each other. And, you know, they went into that business knowing the rules. And if you broke the rules, then there was restitution, you know, to be played. But there was honor. People didn't lie to one another back then, not at all.
Right, and the reason that a lot of them did, you know, get into groups, I mean, obviously it was to protect their inheritance or their family. It was just a way to stick up for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but times were different back then. You know, I'm very, very sad, and I help you very much. I support you in your effort to try to educate people. But back in those days, the family was very strong, and it's not as strong today. And, you know, I mean, I can remember my husband, you know, saying that he had, because we grew up in Chicago. Chicago is a tough city, and there's lots of opportunities, you know, to go into a gang and, you know, do these kinds of things. But he wouldn't do it because he didn't want to embarrass his mother and father. He didn't want to bring shame on them. That's the difference, you know, today and back then. I don't see that in as much existence. It's still there, and I see it, you know, in a lot of places, but not as much as it was back then.
Right. Yeah, the family, definitely, you know, whether it's real family or, you know, mafia family, any kind of institution that you want to call family has definitely broken down. I mean, even,
correct,
you know, our own family's mom and dad, kids, you know, there's a big lack of respect, a big lack of honor, and, you know, I'm not sure exactly where all that broke down, you know, but people really do need to get back to, you know, honor your parents, honor your family, you
correct,
know, your leaders, your elders.
Correct. Correct.
And that's,
you know,
a big problem in society today.
I mean, you know, all things work through God, and I don't know why we are in this transition period right now, but I'm sure hoping that there will be a turnaround and people can go back to the real human values. I mean, where you honor. I mean, I could have written any kind of a book, you know, if I wanted just to have a bestseller. I mean, you know, how easy would it have been for me to say all kinds of terrible things about Al Capone and Al Capone's family and things like that? But I want to honor my ancestors. My ancestors went through a lot in their lives to allow me to lead this life. I've got to honor them. I've got to say thank you to them for all of the work. You know, they toiled, they lived in tenements and things like that, and I'm here today to show them that it was all worth their sacrifice.
Exactly.
So maybe that's the message that you can, you know, get out to those kids, that they have ancestors up there in heaven who really did the things that they did because they wanted to make life easier for their descendants, for their offspring.
Definitely. You know, and I remember my grandparents, and, you know, they taught us a great, valuable, you know, work ethic. They were very hard workers, you know.
Correct.
They were immigrants, you know, and their ancestors were immigrants, but yet they came here and made something of themselves. And not that they were, you know, that they had a lot of money or anything, but they had integrity and they had honor and they had
integrity
and they had work ethics, and they taught those values to us, you know, and every
correct
one of my aunts and uncles and you know, most of my cousins, they all have great work ethics, and they
mm-hmm
use their talents to get ahead. You know, no matter what it is, and you know, my
life is not a bed of roses. You know, but it's how you treat the circumstances. It's what you allow the circumstances to create you. You know, if you have self-respect, and if you, you know, honor your mother and your father, then you're not going to let those kinds of things beat you down. I mean, we've all gone through, you know, horrendous events, life-changing. I've gone through some life-changing events. And, yeah, it does take your breath away. But then, you know, you sit down, you say a few prayers, you look up to heaven and say, you know, help me through this, God. Just one more time. Let's get through this.
Exactly. You know, and that's definitely true about, you know, every one of us have had some hard times, and if you haven't, well, that's great. But I think most of us, you know, definitely life is hard, and especially in our time. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hear a few more stories from you in a little bit. But we tell the kids now, everything that you do is a choice, whether, you know, it's good or bad. You know, any one of us could go buy some drugs on the, you know, in the streets. It's not a hard thing to get a hold of.
No.
You know, and we could turn it around in a day and make some good money. You know, we could all, you know, it's fast money. That's no mm-hmm. lie. But it's wrong. It's illegal. And so, you know, our choices, I mean, everything we do is a choice. Mm-hmm. And then we have to live with the consequence of that decision that we made. You know, that's one of the things that we stress out here to the kids, that, you know, to stay in school, get your education, and use that to make the right choices in life and to be able to get ahead, you know, in anything you want to do. But just, you know, get your education and make the right choices. You know, if you do come up across a struggle, there's people out here that are here to help you and help to get you through that. And mm-hmm. The other thing I was going to go back to mention, too, is that society, a lot of it is the way it is because of the way the media portrays.
Correct.
All the, you know, the things in the past, the gangster movies, the gangster rap, you know, all of those things try to embellish how great that life is, when in reality we know that all of those things are fake, they're not real. And,
correct.
You know, there may be a couple of people out there, you know, and a lot of people that made good money, but a lot of them either died or went to prison. And so
correct.
In the end, it wasn't worth it. It wasn't right. And, you know, we just try to stress that to the kids now, that, you know, it's very short-lived and it doesn't last. So get your education, because that's the only thing that nobody can take from you, and you make the right decision.
Absolutely.
The media definitely has had a great influence over how the society now is very disrespectful, whether it be, you know, towards honor and respect, but, you know, especially, you know, to women, degrading women, and there's just so many different things that has happened and have been happening, you know, for this.
Well, I'm a very good one to support you in that, because I know what the media did to my family. My family is not the way the media has portrayed them. Al Capone is not the way the media has portrayed him. If he were here today, he would help you try to curb the gang violence and the gang mentality. He would work very hard to help you in what you're doing.
Definitely. You know, and like I said, most gangsters are not out there because they want to be mean, they want to kill people, they want to do things that, you know, the gangsters are portrayed as doing, but they're just there to help their families, to make money. And like you said, they, you know, they took care of their families at any cost. You know, they did what was their opportunity at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, just like going back to the 80s when crack cocaine came out, you know, it was an opportunity for a lot of young black people. And here I'm going to give my opinion, but, you know, the CIA brought it to the inner cities.
Yep.
So what else are the young black men going to do when they see this opportunity and it's a way to make money? For them, they think they're getting out of the ghetto or the neighborhood to make a better
right.
life. But in the end, it really held them down further. And
mm-hmm.
At this moment, I'm going to hand the mic over to Rob, because Rob actually lived that life, you know, was a drug dealer and a boss during that time. I'm going to let him tell his story and his opinion.
Okay.
Hey, how you doing, Ms. Capone? It's a pleasure, like I said, an honor to have you on the show tonight. And
Thank you,
yes, ma'am. And I've been sitting here listening to everything. And, most drug dealers are not bad people. We just get caught up in the fast money. And back in my time, and even back in Al Capone's time, you know, the bottom line was taking care of family by any means necessary, you know. And a lot of people get it twisted out here and just think it's all about, I'm going to go sell these drugs. But what they fail to realize, murder and hustling go hand in hand, you know. You can't be in the game if you're not no strong guy. You know, that's the bottom line. You know, that life is very short lived. You might make millions and all of that, but at the end of the journey, they got a cage for you that they hold the key to every penitentiary in America and outside America. And once they put you in that cage, you know, it's a whole different ball game that they sing in now, you know, and they putting drugs in somebody else's hand now. So it's a non-win-win situation. You will never win against the government. You will never win against these people they call the CIA, the feds, or none of that, you know, because no hustler hold a key to no penitentiary nowhere. Once they lock that key, it's game over, lights out. So I respect you for writing, you know, your book, and I would like for you to tell the fans where they can order that book at and let them know that.
Well, they can get the book at all bookstores. Every place, you know, any place that sells books can order this book. They can get it in a digital form by going to either Barnes & Noble and getting the Nook or going to Amazon getting Kindle. Amazon has it. They can also buy a personally autographed book. I will sign it over to them by going to my website, which is www.UncleAlCapone.com. And it's a secure site. They can pay with a credit card there, and then I will mail it out to them. You know, but it's, you know, I think so far it's an award-winning book. People have enjoyed reading it. And it's, you know, I hope getting a message out there to people, too, about a woman that could survive that kind of stuff.
Yes, ma'am. And we definitely, you know, is glad, like I said, that you're here to speak on that to these youngsters out here. And what positive message will you give these youngsters out here that's trying to live an Al Capone life or other gangsters' life that's been out here in the world, you know?
Oh, dear. I'm so sorry that my uncle is a poster boy for that kind of life, because I can promise all of your followers that he would not want that at all for anybody. He, you know, my family were the first ones to give blacks the opportunity to perform. They opened up, they started the Cotton Club. And my uncle used to have armed guards for the black entertainers when they would come out of the black neighborhood into downtown Chicago to perform. He would protect them, you know, but he gave them the opportunity to do something that they wanted to do. No, he didn't like, and he would not support that kind of gang activity. He would tell them to go home and be with their families.
And, you know, I have to respect you on that too, Ms. Capone, because, I had, knew about that from research on Mr. Al Capone, you know, about how he wasn't a discriminating guy, you know, at the end of his day. Money was green to him, you know, at the end of his day, money was green. It wasn't black or white, you know what I'm saying?
Correct.
And, you know, he was about his business on that. So I had to give
Correct.
All shout out to Al for not being prejudiced or discriminating towards nobody on that page. So I had to give big ups to your family on that.
My whole family is like that. We don't see color. We see a soul. We see a heart. We see the person for what they are.
Right. So we definitely loving that. And we would just like to say, Ms. Capone, can you elaborate on a little more of your book?
Well, again, it's my story, and it's a story of really the media creating bias against the Capone name, and then having to exist under that. children were not allowed to play with me. I know what it's like to be black. That's how I was treated. My father was fired from jobs. I was fired from a job. And it got to be so bad that my father took his own life just before my 11th birthday. It just was very, very difficult to constantly try to prove that, hey, we're not what you think we are.
You were 7 when Al Capone died, and then
correct.
You were 11. And he was, you know, every one of us has, a favorite aunt or uncle maybe, but Al Capone was your favorite, and I think that's why maybe you remember more things about him.
You have to remember, yes, he did die on my 7th birthday, but I had my grandfather telling me, you know, and reminding me about things till I was 34, and then their only sister until I was 43. So, I mean, you know, you'd get together as a family, and we would say, oh, remember when this happened? Oh, remember when you fell out of the apple tree, and you know, yes. Al picked you up and taught you to play the mandolin. So, I mean, those kinds of stories were always repeated as we sat around the dinner table and talked.
Right. And those are great family times.
Yep,
you know,
yep.
We can all sit around and joke and laugh and tease and just have a good time. So then your dad killed himself at 11, and at that time you were using your father's middle name as your last name. And
correct.
So up until that point, nobody really knew, I guess, that you were a Capone. So tell us.
Well, they did.
They
did when Al died. My family needed something joyous to look forward to after Al died. So I was raised a Catholic, and Catholic children make their first communion when they are 7 and in second grade. So the Capone family needed something joyous, and so they planned this huge party. All the Capone family came to the church to watch me make my first communion, and then we went back to the Prairie Avenue house for a big celebration. Well, in those days, they had local editions of the big papers. So the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago American on Monday put out their local edition, and they said, you know, the children from St. Philip Neri, you know, made their first communion, and Deirdre Capone with the entire Capone family in attendance made hers. Well, how many Deirdres do you think were in the city of Chicago in 1947? And how many do you think went to St. Philip Neri School? One.
Right.
And that's 2 weeks later, every single child in my second grade class was invited to this girl's birthday party and not me.
Wow.
And that's when it started. No one could ever have anything to do with me. I had no friends. I was a latchkey kid. I was always by myself. A new girl came into the school in sixth grade, and I literally, you know, handcuffed her and said, you're going to be my friend, because she didn't know who I was. So, I mean, that's exactly the way it was. I mean, just no one would have anything to do with me.
That's got to be hard for any child. You know, how did you?
Well, it is. Yeah, it is. Because what did I do? You know, why did I deserve that? And I think a lot of the people that you reach out to are probably saying that too. Well, you know, why did I deserve that? Why did they treat me like that? So, if they think I'm bad, or maybe I should be bad. You know, and I had those opportunities. But, you know, I'm here today to tell the story.
Definitely. So, as you got a little bit older, did it get any easier? Did you still, obviously, as an younger person, you lost a job because of that name?
I didn't even tell my children who they were until they were teenagers. I was very afraid. I thought they were going to hate me, you know, because it was so horrific for me to be a Capone. That, you know, I thought, oh, my God, they're going to hate me that they've got this DNA. And it took all my courage to tell them. And I had 4 children, and they're standing there with these big eyes because they didn't know what in the world I was about to tell them. And when I told them, they looked at each other, and then they looked back at me, and in unison, the 4 of them looked at me and said, cool, Mom. And I thought, whoa. oh, whoa, we've turned a corner here, which was what I didn't expect that at all.
And that's because of the media, I guess, you know, and them portraying the gangster mobster movies.
Yeah.
And
yep.
I read somewhere that one of your sons was actually learning about that in school, and that's what brought that up to you.
He came home from school, and I asked him, hey, Bob, what did you learn in school today? And he says, oh, we learned about this gangster by the name of Al Capone. And I went, oh, no. All right. Okay. We have to have a talk here.
Right. You know, and it's just, it's funny because I could see my kids saying the same thing. Cool. You know, because now, nowadays it's supposed to be a gangster. So it's like, don't mess with me because I'm a Capone.
Yeah. But I just didn't expect it, Lucinda. It was like, whoa, glory be.
Right. But it definitely wasn't cool for you when you were growing up. You went through a lot of hard times.
And I tried the best I could to tell that story in my book, Uncle Al Capone. But in there, they're also going to find out, you know, who is this man? I put a picture on the front of the book, and it's Al Capone, but he doesn't have a big fedora. He doesn't have a cigar in his fingers, but he does have three cigars in his shirt pocket. You know, and then when you look at the picture inside with me, with him, if you look real close, you'll see I'm wearing his straw hat, and I also have his cigar in my mouth.
What was so bad for your father at that time that would make him commit suicide?
It was in 1950, and this was 3 years, of course, after Al passed. And there was a man making a run for presidency. It was a senator by the name of Estes Kefauver. And a lot of people in America in 1950 had just gotten these little television sets, and it was a big thing for the families to sit down and eat dinner. That's when TV dinners came about, and you'd sit down and you'd all watch television. Well, in order to garner a lot of media attention, Estes Kefauver decided to open up the Senate investigation into racketeering. And the first person he called to Washington, D.C. to testify was my grandfather. And for three consecutive nights, this was televised to anybody that had a television set in America, and they would ask my grandfather questions. And he would sit there and just raise his hand and say, I stand on the fifth, I plead the fifth, I plead the fifth, and never answered any of those questions. But my father was so afraid that, you know, everything was just going to start again. It was like, you know, it was much like, do you guys know about Bernie Madoff and his son committing suicide?
No.
Well, Bernie Madoff is that man that just swindled all these people out of their hard-earned dollars, you know, with his scheme of, you know, investing and stuff. Well, Bernie Madoff's son was a fine young man, much like my father, very well educated, had a family, had two children, and he couldn't take it. You know, the people were now thinking that he was just like his father, so he hung himself.
Wow. That's
now, Mrs. Madoff has since changed her name and changed her children's name. So to try to have her children escape that persecution, and that's much like it happened in the Capone family, most of the people changed their name. I did not. I was a girl, you know, the thinking was that, you know, my name would change when I would get married, so why go to the expense of changing it? So that, I was born a Capone, and that is, you know, still my legal name. I've got a married name, but that's still my legal name.
Right. Tell us a little bit about I read here that Al Capone had a Cadillac that he had fitted with a bulletproof glass, run flat tires, and a siren, and it was eventually seized from him and later used for President Franklin D. Roosevelt as his limousine.
Correct. And that car now is being purchased by a group of businessmen. I am working with a group of businessmen, and we are putting together a touring exhibit. And we will be taking this exhibit into the various, you know, smaller towns and places around the United States. And that car will tour with us, as will the Al Capone diamond that is almost 11 carats. And there's gambling equipment, there's other artifacts, there's, you know, pictures that nobody else has ever seen. There's, you know, just all kinds of things that will tour around the United States. And I will go with the tour, so, if, you know, if people want me to sign their books and stuff, I will do that.
Definitely. And tell us, you know, we know that Al Capone is known, you know, one of the big things he was known for was St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Tell us what you know about that story and the real version.
Al Capone had absolutely nothing to do with that. And if he did, it wouldn't have been that M.O. I mean, he would have not put anything like that together. At the time of that murder, Al was in Florida pleading his case to the income tax people. He offered the income tax people $4.5 million. Just, here, take the money, and, you know, I've paid my debt, and they wouldn't do it. My grandfather told me the real story. I needed to make sure it was real before I put it in a book, and I do have absolutely solid evidence. What it was is, back in those times, the politicians, policemen, and the mobsters all worked together. I mean, people wanted alcohol, they wanted gambling, you know, they wanted sex. So they set up these businesses, and in order for these businesses to run smooth, there was payouts to politicians, there were payouts to the police. The police were every bit as involved in those businesses, and so were the politicians. The politicians wanted people to vote for them, you know, so of course they're going to help people have alcohol so that, you know, people would vote them into office. That's the game that they play. Well, some politicians, you know, decided that they wanted to get the liquor and sell it themselves so that they could get some extra money, because this, remember, it's after the stock market crash, so money was really tight. And so Bugs Moran's soldiers saw these policemen stealing the liquor off the back of their trucks out in the alley. And Moran's soldiers went up and said, you know, guys, you're not supposed to do this. You know, this is not something that you do. You know, if you don't stop, we're going to turn you into the lieutenant. And they didn't stop. So, you know, they were going to turn him into the lieutenant. And, of course, if that happened, they would have lost their jobs. So it was the police that did it.
Right.
And they tried to frame Al Capone for it. But, again, it was not the M.O. Al Capone would not have ever done anything like that. And, I mean, he just would not do that. That's not what my family would have done.
Right. You know, that's one of my biggest pet peeves, too. As I've learned over the last couple of years, you know, a lot more about gangs and drugs and history in the United States. And, you know, as far back as, you know, well, this whole century that I can, you know, talk about, I guess, you know, the mafia and the mobsters and gangsters were definitely in cahoots with, you know, with the president and the senators and the Republicans and the, you know, the CIA is, you know, I could say probably the biggest mafia family in the United States. They were doing the same thing. They were using their power and control to do whatever they needed to do on that end. You know, so it just, you know, the corruption didn't just start a few years ago. It goes way back. And, you know, and everybody was involved together. You know, everybody got together and put whoever they wanted in office. You know, there's just so many things that people need to really wake up and learn about and understand so that, you know, if they want this country to turn around in a positive way, they need to search their history, and they need to all stand up for what they believe in and stand up for, you know, more positive things. I don't believe that anything will ever change in this country because, I'm working on a book, and I've been working on it for almost 2 years now, and I'm just, every time I think, well, let me finish it up, you know, I learn something else, or I learn something different. And, you know, it's just so amazing. And the title of my book is going to be Under Pressure, The Melting Pot of Corruption. You know, I always grew up thinking, you know, immigration into the United States was one of the greatest things. I thought, you know, that's what kind of, I guess, my opinion of how I understood things growing up. You know, that was such a great thing for the, you know, immigration, and we were the melting pot of the world, and it was, you know, because we were so great. And now to be so disappointed knowing that, you know, it wasn't a melting pot of positive, you know, happiness. It was a melting pot of corruption. I mean, that's what it turned into be.
Yeah. It did, and it didn't have to.
Right.
But when you've got people that are being paid to represent us, and then they just turn around and it's all graft, and, you know, who cares about the little guy, then you've got that kind of oppression. So, yeah, keep up the good work, guys. I applaud you for the message that you're getting out there, and get that book finished, Lucinda. I know it's hard. I mean, I used to sit in that room and tears would, you know, flow down my cheeks. But, you know, just make the decision to get it done. So if there's anything, I could ever help you with in the future, just reach out and give me a call, too.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. You know, we as leaders and people, you know, they need to stand up. You know, and in the past, a lot of people that stand up and state the truth, you know, something usually ends up happening to them. But, you know, people do really need to stand up as a people of the nation, get together and stand up and, What's that?
Tell your followers it only takes one. Jesus was one man.
That's right.
And it just takes one brave, honest soul, but they've got to be honest.
Right.
We've got to trust them.
That's the problem today. You know, there's still crooked cops. There's still crooked leaders. There's still, you know, and it's always, you know, I don't know if it'll ever change. I have to say maybe it'll always be like that. There's always going to be somebody that's willing to close their eyes and take money or, you know. And living here in Arizona, I grew up in southern Arizona. So, you know, the immigration thing is a big deal out here. And, you know, my point is that, you know, it doesn't matter how many fences you build or how many, you know, things that, you know, how many people you put down here on the border, it's not going to change the fact that, you know, drugs are coming over on airplanes. People are closing their eyes. People are still driving through the border because there's people closing their eyes. You know, there's always going to be a guard down, you know, in the middle of nowhere that's going to turn his back if you hand him, you know, a few thousand dollars. So, you know, these laws are not.
Well, if you could do one thing, you two, if you could get Hollywood to stop glamorizing drugs, there you go.
Definitely.
That's
if people would realize the hard thing that it's caused on everybody.
That's one big piece. You know, when you see them willing to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on a few moments of ecstasy or something, and, you know, these people look at it and they emulate them. They want to be like them.
Exactly. You know, and like you said, I agree with you, Ms. Capone. You know, what Hollywood needs to do is not glamorize that gangster and that street life, because If you're going to make a picture about the gangster life and stuff like that, well, you, at the end of the movie, you need to let these youths and others know it's two ways out of that game, man. It's going to be death or the penitentiary for the rest of your life, and your homeboy going to turn state on you, and he going to be somewhere in the witness protection program, and that's going to be the same guy that done ate at your mama's table and done played sandbox with you, you know?
Yep.
So
yep.
Don't get it twisted that, you know, you're the first man who picked up a gun or you're the first man who picked up a pack of dope. You know what I mean? All that is failure, man, and people need to start recognizing that. You know, they bring these drugs over here, but we have an opportunity to say, no, I'm not going to sell your drugs, because if I sell your drugs, I'm not going to live up on that hill for the rest of my life in glamour. What's going to happen is, I'm going to be dead, I'm going to be in the penitentiary somewhere, and then you'll be handing the drug to somebody else. So it's like a revolving door with the drug trade.
Correct.
And a lot of these youngsters need to understand that. You're not doing nothing that nobody else ain't never did, bro. Selling dope and trying to be a gangster, them the oldest two failures in American history, bro. So don't get it twisted like you first man who done did that.
Yep, absolutely. Keep getting that out there, Rob. That's a very, very good point.
I have to keep pushing the envelope like that, you know, because it's a lot of my homeboys that's just not coming home off an 18-year bitch, 20-year prison bitch, 24-year prison bitch, you know. So don't get it twisted like you're doing something that ain't nobody else did out here, man. You know what I'm saying? That anybody can pick up failure, but can anybody, you know what I mean, push the envelope to the limit to achieve something in life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We need more doctors, lawyers, scientists, whatever you feel you want to become, because we done had enough drug dealers, we done had enough wannabe gangsters, we done had enough thugs, and we done had enough gangbangers, and you already know where you go, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's no in-between. Either you riding with the real or you riding with the wrong. It ain't no straddling, no fence. And that's the bottom line on how I bring it, you know?
Correct. Nope. You've got a good message there, both of you. So I applaud you and just keep it up.
Oh, yeah. I thank you, too, for the message you have brought tonight, too, Ms. Capone, for our viewers. And,
thank you very much, boys.
Any last words would you like to say? Any last comments you would like to say?
Thanks, guys, and keep up the good work. I really do applaud you for what you're doing.
Hey, thank you very much, Ms. Capone, for coming on the show tonight.
Okay. Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Lucinda.
Thank you.
All right. God bless now.
God bless you, too, both of you. Bye-bye.